This is Audible.
Penguin Audiobooks presents In This Mountain by Jan Caron. Read by John McDonough. Soli Deo Gloria. To God alone be the glory. And in this mountain the Lord of hosts will make for all people a feast of choice pieces, a feast of wines on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of well-refined wines on the lees. Isaiah chapter 25, verse 6, New King James Version. Chapter 1. Go and tell. Moles again. Father Tim Cavanaugh stood on the front steps of the yellow house and looked with dismay at the mounds of raw earth disgorged upon his frozen March grass. Holes pocked the lawn, causing it to resemble a lunar surface. Berms of dirt crisscrossed the yard like stone walls viewed from an Irish hilltop. He glanced across the driveway to the rectory, once his home, and now his rental property, where the pesky Talpidae were entertaining themselves in precisely the same fashion. Indeed, they had nearly uprooted Helene Pringle's modest sign, Lessons for the Piano, Inquire Within. It slanted drunkenly to the right. Year after year he'd tried his hand at mole removal remedies, but the varmints had one-upped him repeatedly. In truth, they appeared to relish coming back for more, and in greater numbers. He walked into the yard and gave the nearest mound a swift kick. Blast moles to the other side of the moon, and leave it to him to have a wife who wanted them caught in traps and carted to the country where they might frolic in a meadow among buttercups and bluebells. And who was to do the catching and carting? Yours truly. He went inside to his study and called the hard-to-beat hardware in Wesley, believing since childhood that hardware stores somehow had the answers to life's more vexing problems. "Voles!" exclaimed the hardware man. "What most people have got is voles. They just think they're moles." "Uh-huh. What voles do is eat the roots of your plants, chow down on your bulbs and all. Have your bulbs bloomed the last few years?"
"Why, yes, yes, they have."
The hardware man sighed. "So maybe it is moles. Well, they're in there for the grubs, you know. What you have to do is kill the grubs."
"I was thinking more about, taking out the moles."
"Can't do that no more. State law."
Even the government had jumped on the bandwagon for moles, demonstrating yet again what government had come to in this country.
"So, how do you get rid of grubs?"
"Poison."
"I see. Course, some say don't use it if you got dogs and cats. You got dogs and cats?"
"We do."
He called Dora Pugh at the hardware on Main Street.
"Whirligigs," said Dora. "You know those little wooden propeller-like things on a stick? Old man Mueller used to make 'em. They come painted and all, to look like ducks and geese and whatnot. When the wind blows, their wings fly around. That's the propellers. And the commotion sends sound waves down their tunnels and chases 'em out. But you have to use a good many whirligigs."
He didn't think his wife would like their lawn studded with whirligigs.
"Plus, there's something that works on batteries that you stick in the ground. Only thing is, I'd have to order it special, which takes 6 weeks, and by then..."
"They'd probably be gone anyway."
"Right,"
said Dora, clamping the phone between her left ear and shoulder while bagging seed corn. He queried Percy Mosley, longtime proprietor of the Main Street Grill.
"What can you do to get rid of moles?"
Percy labeled this a dumb question.
"Catch 'em by the tail and bite their heads off is what I do."
On his way to the post office, he met Jean Bolick, leaving the annual sale on boiled wool items at the Irish woolen shop. Jean's brain tumor, inoperable because of its location near the brain stem, had caused him to teeter as he walked, a sight Father Tim did not relish seeing in his old friend and parishioner.
"Look here," Jean held up a parcel. "Cardigan sweater with leather buttons, 50% off. And another 20% today only. Better get in there while the getting's good."
"No thanks. The Busy Fingers crowd in Whitecap knitted me a cardigan that will outlast the Sphinx. Tell me, buddy, do you know anything about getting rid of moles?"
"Moles? My daddy always hollered in their holes, and they took off every which way."
"What did he say when he hollered?"
Jean cleared his throat, tilted toward Father Tim's right ear, and repeated the short but fervent litany.
"My goodness," said the earnest gardener, blushing to the very roots of what hair he had left.
He heard the receiver being crushed against the capacious bosom of his bishop's secretary, and a muffled conversation. He thought it appealingly quaint not to be put on hold, and have his ear blasted with music he didn't want to hear in the first place.
"Timothy, a blessed Easter to you."
"And to you, Stuart.
I was thinking of you only this morning."
"Whatever for? Some interim pulpit assignment in Outer Mongolia?"
"No, just thinking that we haven't had a really decent chinwag in, good heavens, since before you went down to Whitecap."
"An eon, to be precise."
"Well, a couple of years, anyway."
"Come and have lunch with me," suggested his bishop, sounding what? Pensive? Wistful?
"I'll do it," he said, decidedly spontaneous after last Sunday's Easter celebration.
"I've been meaning to come for a visit. There's something I'd like us to talk over. I may have a crate of moles that must be taken to the country. I can release them on my way to you."
"A crate of moles?"
"Yes." He didn't want to discuss it further.
But he couldn't catch the blasted things. He prodded their tunnels with sticks, a burlap sack at the ready. He shouted into their burrows, repeating what Jean had recommended, though in a low voice. He blew his honorary Mitford Red's coach's whistle. He stomped on the ground like thunder.
"I give up," he told his wife, teeth chattering from the cold. He noted the streak of blue watercolor on her chin, a sure sign she was working on her current children's book, starring Violet, the real-life white cat who usually resided atop their refrigerator.
"But you just started."
"Started? I've been working at it a full half hour."
10 minutes max," Cynthia said. "I watched you, and I must say I never heard of getting rid of moles by shouting down their tunnels."
He pulled his gloves off his frozen hands and sat on a kitchen stool, disgusted. His dog sprawled at his feet and yawned.
"I mean, what were you saying when you shouted?"
He had no intention of telling her.
"If you still want them caught and crated up, you do the catching and crating, and I'll haul them to the country. A fair division of labor."
He was sick of the whole business.
Cynthia glared at him as if she were his fifth-grade teacher, and he a dunce on the stool. "Why don't you just stop fretting over it, Timothy? Let them have their day."
"Have their day. That was the artistic temperament for you.
But they're ruining the lawn I've slaved over for years, the lawn you dreamed of, longed for, indeed craved, so that you might walk on it barefoot, and I quote, as upon a bolt of unfurled velvet."
"Oh, for heaven's sake, did I say such a silly thing?"
He rolled his eyes. "Timothy, you know that if you simply turn your head for a while, the humps will go down, the holes will fill in, and by May or June the lawn will be just fine."
She was right, of course, but that wasn't the point.
"I love you bunches,"
she said cheerily, trotting down the hall to her studio. He pulled on his running clothes with the eagerness of a kid yanked from bed on the day of a test he hadn't studied for. Exercise was good medicine for diabetes, but he didn't have to like it. In truth, he wondered why he didn't enjoy running anymore. He'd once enjoyed it immensely. "Peaks and valleys," he muttered. His biannual checkup was just around the bend, and he was going to walk into Hoppy Harper's office looking good. As the Lord's Chapel bells tolled noon, he was hightailing it to the Main Street Grill, where a birthday lunch for J.C. Hogan would be held in the rear booth. Flying out the door of Happy Endings Bookstore, he hooked a left and crashed into someone, nearly knocking her to the pavement. Edith Mallory staggered backward, regained her balance, and gave him a look that made his blood run cold.
"Edith, I'm terribly sorry."
"Why don't you watch where you're going?" She jerked the broad collar of a dark mink coat more securely around her face. "Clergy," she said with evident distaste. "They're always preoccupied with lofty thoughts, aren't they?" Not waiting for an answer, she swept past him into Happy Endings, where the bell jingled wildly on the door.
"Er high muckety-muck traipsed by a minute ago," said Percy Mosley, wiping off the table of the rear booth.
Father Tim noted that the slur of her perfume had been left on his clothes.
"I just ran into her."
"I'd like to run into her," said the grill owner, "with a 18-wheeler."
If there was anyone in town who disliked Edith Mallory more than himself, it was Percy Mosley, who, a few years ago, had nearly lost his business to Edith's underhanded landlord tactics. It was clergy, namely yours truly, who had brought her nefarious ambitions to utter ruin. Thus, if there was anyone in town whom Edith Mallory could be presumed to despise more than Tim Cavanaugh, he didn't have a clue who it might be.
"Every time I think I've seen the last of that witch on a broom, back she comes like a dog to his vomit."
"Cool it, Percy. Your blood pressure."
"And Ed Coffey's still driving her around in that Lincoln like the Queen of England. He ought to be ashamed of his sorry self. He's brought disgrace on the whole Coffey line."
J.C. Hogan, news editor and grill regular, slammed his overstuffed briefcase into the booth and slid in.
"You'll never guess what's hit Main Street." Percy looked fierce. "Don't even mention her name in my place. Joe Ivy and Fancy Skinner are locked in a price war."
J.C. pulled a large handkerchief from his hip pocket and wiped his face.
"A price war?" asked Father Tim.
"Head to head, you might say. Fancy had this big sign painted and put in her window upstairs, said, 'Haircuts, $12, all welcome.' First thing you know, Joe puts a sign downstairs, says, 'Haircuts, $11.
Joe Ivy's one-chair barber shop was located in a former storage room behind the kitchen of his sister's sweet stuff bakery. The only other game in town was Fancy Skinner's unisex hair salon, a cut above, which rented the upstairs area over the bakery. Poetic irony is what one grill customer called the arrangement.
So Fancy cranks her price down to $10 and has her sign repainted. Then Joe drops his price, changes his sign, and gives me an ad that says, 'Haircuts $9.50. Free chocolate chip cookie to every customer.'"
"Cutthroat," said Percy.
"I don't know where this'll end," said J.C., "but if you need a haircut, now's the time."
"Happy birthday."
Father Tim thought they should get to the point.
"Right, happy birthday," said Percy. "You can be one of the first to order off of my new menu."
J.C. scowled. "I was used to the old menu."
"This is mine Velma's last year in this hole in the wall. I wanted to go out with a bang."
Percy stepped to the counter and proudly removed three menus on which the ink was scarcely dry and handed them around. He thought the Wesley printer had come up with a great idea for this new batch. The cover showed the grill motto set in green letters that were sort of swirling up like steam from a coffee mug. "Eat here once, and you'll be a regular."
"Where's Mule at?" asked Percy.
"Beats me," said Father Tim, "probably getting a haircut."
"So how old are you?"
Percy wanted to know. J.C. grinned.
14 going on 15 is what Adele says." "Gag me with a forklift," said Mule, skidding into the booth. "He's 56, big ones. I know because I saw his driver's license when he wrote a check at Shoe Barn."
"Okay, give me your order and hop to it. Velma's having a perm down at Fancy's, and I'm short-handed. Free coffee in this booth today only."
"I don't want coffee," said Mule. "I was thinking more like sweet iced tea."
"Coffee's free. Tea's another deal."
J.C. opened his menu looking grim.
"You spelled potato wrong," he announced.
"Where at?" asked Percy.
"Right here where it says tuna croissant with potato chips. There's no E in potato."
"Since when?"
"Since ever."
"Look who's talking," thought Father Tim.
"I'll be darned," said Mule. "Taco salad. Can you sell taco salad in this town?"
"Taco salad," muttered Percy, writing on his order pad.
"Wait a minute, I didn't say I wanted taco salad, I was just discussing it."
"I don't have time for discussing," said Percy. "I got a lunch crowd coming in."
Father Tim noticed Percy's face was beet red. Blood pressure, the stress of a new menu.
"So what is a taco salad, anyway?" asked Mule.
The Muse editor looked up in amazement.
"Have you been living under a rock? Taco salad is salad in a taco, for Pete's sake."
"No, it ain't," said Percy. "It's salad in a bowl with taco chips scattered on top."
Mule sank back in the booth, looking depressed.
"I'll have what I've been having before the new menu. A grilled pimento cheese on white bread, hold the mayo."
"Do you see anything on this menu saying pimento cheese? On this menu, we don't have pimento cheese. We ain't gonna get pimento cheese, and that's the end of it."
The proprietor stomped away, looking disgusted.
"You made him mad," said J.C., wiping his face with his handkerchief.
"How can a man make a living without pimento cheese on his menu?" Mule asked.
"Unless you want to run down to the tea shop and sit with the women, there's nowhere else to eat lunch in this town."
J.C. poked the menu.
"So you better pick something off of here. How about a fish burger? Look at 4 ounces breaded and deep-fried haddock fillet served on a grilled bun with lettuce, tomato, and tartar sauce."
"I don't like tartar sauce."
Father Tim thought he might slide to the floor and lie prostrate. "I'm having the chef's salad," he announced, hoping to set an example. Mule looked relieved.
"Fine, that's what I'll have."
He drummed his finger on the table.
"On the other hand, you never know what's in a chef's salad when you deal with this chef." "I'm having the tuna melt," said J.C., "plus the fish burger and potato skins." "Help yourself," said Mule. "Have whatever you want. It's on us."
He peered intently at the menu.
"Chili crowned with tortilla chips and cheese. That might be good."
"Here he comes. Make up your mind," snapped J.C.
"I'll have the chili deal," said Mule,
declining eye contact with Percy.
"But only if it comes without beans."
Percy gave him a stony look.
"How can you have chili without beans? That's like a cheeseburger without cheese."
"Right," said J.C., "or a BLT without bacon."
Father Tim closed his eyes as if in prayer, feeling his blood sugar plummet into his loafers.
"So what are you doing these days?"
It was a casual and altogether harmless question, the sort of thing anyone might inquire of the retired, but he hated it. And now, on the heels of the very same question asked only yesterday by a former parishioner,
"So what in the dickens do you do all day?"
Mule had left to show a house, J.C. had trudged upstairs to work on Monday's layout, and Percy stood beside the rear booth, squinting at him as if he were a beetle on a pin. After nearly 4 years of retirement, why hadn't he been able to formulate a pat answer? He usually reported that he supplied various churches here and there, which was true, of course, but it sounded lame. Indeed, he once said without thinking, "Oh, nothing much." Upon hearing such foolishness out of his mouth, he felt covered with shame. In his opinion, God hadn't put anyone on earth to do nothing much. Thus, in the first year following his interim at Whitecap, he'd given endless hours to the Wesley Children's Hospital, second only to the church as his favorite charitable institution. He had even agreed to do something he roundly despised, raise funds. To his amazement, he had actually raised some. He'd also worked on the lawns of the rectory and the yellow house until people had been known to slow their cars and stare. Occasionally, a total stranger would park at the curb and ask if they could take a picture. During the second year, he'd given a hand to their new mayor, Andrew Gregory, and supplied pulpits in Wesley, Holding, Charlotte, Asheville, Morganton, Johnson City, and for a span of several months, Hickory. Somehow it had been enough, almost. He was never unaware that something was gnawing at him. He couldn't say what. Perhaps it was nothing more or less than his masculine ego needing a good size feeding. In any case, there was a certain restlessness in his spirit, something of feeling unworthy and not quite up to things any more. His wife suggested they go to the Dordogne, or even Africa, and he tried to get excited about traveling to faraway places, but couldn't. In the end, why beat around the bush? A church, that's what he was needing. He was homesick for his own flock to feed, to herd around. Occasionally, he even missed typing a pew bulletin, though he would never have confided such a peculiarity to another living soul. Why had he retired, anyway? He might have stayed on at Lord's Chapel till the cows came home. When he finally severed that comfortable connection, he was hugely up for freedom and adventure, yet now he wondered what he could have been thinking. Sometime during the winter, a compelling thought had occurred to him, something for which he and Cynthia had since been seeking God's wisdom. Not knowing exactly how to press forward with such a notion, he decided to discuss it with Stuart. That would help settle things. In the meantime, he'd begun doing what any self-respecting retired clergyman ought to do. He was writing a book, notably a book of essays that he'd begun on the first day of the new year. The only problem with this was he couldn't tell anyone about it. Percy leaned into the booth and squinted down at him, knitting his brows. Father Tim could practically feel his hot breath.
"So do you lay up in the bed of a morning, or what?"
Percy wouldn't know an essay if he met it on the street. Thus he found himself reporting a list of activities so monumental in length that Percy yawned in his face. Later, he wished he hadn't included the part about cleaning mildew off his old shoes and organizing his socks by color. He also felt that his confession of cooking and washing up most evenings was a little over the top, in fact, certain to be fodder for idle gossip from one end of Main Street to the other. Another thing that dogged him was the uneasy suspicion that writing essays was an indulgent and egocentric thing to do. For that reason, he considered changing horses in midstream and writing his memoirs. Didn't memoirs have a certain cachet these days? In some circles, they were a positive rage. However, he couldn't imagine saying to anyone, "I'm writing my memoirs." Writing about one's life presumed that one had a life worth writing about, and of course he did, but only since marrying his next-door neighbor at the age of 62. Now that was memoir. But no, he wasn't a memoir man. When push came to shove, he was an essay man. He had longed, rather childishly, to reveal his secret to someone. After all, he was more than 90 pages along and very much liking the momentum he'd gained. When Mule didn't show up for breakfast the following morning, due to a treadmill test at the hospital, Father Tim impulsively decided to reveal his personal tidbit to J.C. Hogan, who was as close to literati as Mitford was likely to produce in this lifetime.
"Say that again," said J.C., cupping his ear as if he'd misunderstood.
"Essays," he repeated, suddenly feeling like a perfect idiot.
I'm writing a book of essays."
The Muse editor had a blank look as he forked a sausage link.
"I've read a couple of essays," he said, shoving the sausage into his mouth, and following it with half a buttered biscuit. "Do Femini glog along. Do must have to."
Father Tim sighed. "That's one way of looking at it."
"So," said J.C., "what kind of business do you think Edith Mallory will bring in here when Percy retires?"
"Heaven only knows. It's anybody's guess."
"I could go for a shoe repair," said J.C., coaxing the last of the grape jam from the container. "Or a dry cleaner. I'm over going all the way to Wesley to get my pants pressed."
"You wouldn't have to get 'em pressed if you'd quit hanging 'em on the floor," said Percy.
Percy had visited the editor's bachelor quarters prior to his marriage to Adele, and had been thunderstruck. No matter how hard he tried, Father Tim couldn't imagine meeting J.C. and Mule at the tea shop. It just wouldn't be the same. Besides, Percy had declared he wouldn't be caught dead in the place, which was wallpapered in lavender forget-me-nots with matching ruffled curtains.
"Percy!" J.C. yelled in the direction of the grill. "Who do you think Godzilla will move in here when you retire?"
Percy looked disgusted.
"A pet shop is what Ron Malcolm said was coming."
The very thought of that smell blasting out onto Main Street was enough to make a man throw up his gizzard.
"No way," said J.C. "People in Mitford don't get pets at a pet shop. They wait till something shows up at their back door. Isn't that right?"
he asked Father Tim, who, after all, should know. "O Lord, you are my portion and my cup," he recited in unison with Cynthia and the other congregants at St. Paul's in Wesley. "It is you who uphold my lot. My boundaries enclose a pleasant land. Indeed, I have a goodly heritage. I will bless the Lord who gives me counsel. My heart teaches me night after night. I have set the Lord always before me. Because he is at my right hand, I shall not fall." Cynthia slipped her arm around his waist as they shared the psalter. "My heart, therefore, is glad, and my spirit rejoices. My body also shall rest in hope, for you will not abandon me to the grave, nor let your Holy One see the pit. You will show me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy, and in your right hand are pleasures forevermore." His heart felt warmed by the familiar words, words he had memorized. When? How long ago? Had he been 10 years old? Or 12? He looked upon his wife and was moved by a great tenderness in his breast. The boy who had recited those words before a hushed Sunday school class in Holly Springs, Mississippi. What a miracle that he was standing now in this place in Wesley, North Carolina. More than half a century later, feeling the arm of his wife about his waist and knowing a fullness of joy he'd never believed he might experience. Stuart Cullen didn't appear to be a venerable and much-esteemed bishop. Indeed, at the age of 71, he looked like a man who had just come in from tossing around a football on a back lot. Father Tim felt oddly proud that his bishop and best friend from seminary looked young and vigorous and entirely without airs. It was a sight to make a man puff out his chest, hold in his stomach, and step smartly into the room where Stuart looked up from the antique walnut desk and smiled. "My friend," Stuart exclaimed. They met in the middle of the room and embraced, the bishop feeling fond of his longtime favorite priest, the priest feeling glad he'd never had the ambition to rise to the top, though he knew perfectly well that's where the cream resided in the jug. In truth, he was glad someone else was willing to shoulder the staggering weight of higher church life and leave him in peace. "You look terrific," said Father Tim, meaning it. "And old," Stuart said. "Old? What is old? Old is a matter of—" Stuart chuckled. "Now, Timothy, don't preach me a sermon. Have a seat." He had one, amused to see that he and Stuart were dressed almost identically, both of them wearing khakis, a sport shirt, and a collar. "Gold Dust twins," he said, indicating their gear. "Except you're not old, Timothy." "What is this business about being old? I'm creaking in the joints like a hay wagon." "I always liked your rustic imagery," said Stuart. "Too much Wordsworth at an early age," replied Father Tim. "Speaking of rustic, did you drop your moles off in the country?" "A failed mission," he admitted. "We never caught any to drop off." "I despise moles. Or is it voles? And what's the difference, anyway?"
"You don't need to know," said Father Tim. "Now tell me what's up. You're looking quizzical, or perhaps philosophical."
Stuart sat in a leather wing chair opposite his retired priest and gazed out the window to the garden that his wife cultivated and he putted in. A pink dogwood in early bloom trembled in a gusting wind. He turned his gaze on his visitor.
"I want to build a cathedral."
"Ah." Father Tim reflected a moment on this striking pronouncement. "Building cathedrals isn't a job for the aged."
"Thinking about it has made me face my mortality. It strikes me that I may never live to see it finished. In truth, considering the funds we'll need to raise and the time it will take to raise them, I may not be around for the groundbreaking, much less the dedication. We're not going to borrow a cent, you see."
"Well, then, we may both be dead and gone."
"I'll be 72 in 11 months, at which time, as you know, they'll chase me off with a broom. I've always regretted our strict retirement policy. I've never felt better in my life. Why should I be forced to retire at 72?
"Beats me," said Father Tim.
"In any case, I'm getting a very late start on a cathedral."
"If you don't mind the platitude, it's never too late.
I also wonder whether this notion is merely a self-serving desire for immortality, some strut of the flesh."
They pondered this together quietly. The clock on the mantel ticked.
"Do you think," asked Father Tim, "that the desire for immortality was the driving force behind Michelangelo's David, or Da Vinci's ceiling?"
The bishop crossed his legs and appeared to gaze at the toe of his shoe.
or behind, shall we say, Handel's Messiah. I don't pretend to know what's behind much of anything we humans do. There are days when it seems that everything we do is for unutterably selfish reasons. Then come the days on the mountaintop when we're able to know the galvanizing truth all over again, which is that we earnestly seek to do it all to the glory of God. What has God said to you about this thing? Quite a lot. Actually, I think it's his notion entirely. I'm clever enough, I suppose, but not quite so clever to drum up the particulars of this idea. I must confess that when it all came to me, I wept. Then it has nothing to do with seeing your name chiseled over the door, St. Stuart's on the hill? Stuart laughed. Ah, but Father Tim liked hearing his bishop laugh. Stuart's secretary opened the door and poked her head into the room. I'm off to lunch. I don't suppose the two of you need anything. Only a bit of humility, seasoned with patience and fortitude, said the bishop. On whole wheat or rye? Asked his secretary, closing the door. Some of us, said Stuart, are interested in initiating only what we'll see come to fruition. But I've always looked beyond the present, beyond the day, a propensity that's both a blessing and a curse. Niebuhr spoke to that, said Father Tim. Indeed, he said, nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in our lifetime. Therefore we must be saved by hope. Nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history. Therefore we must be saved by faith. Nothing we do, however virtuous, quoted Father Tim, can be accomplished alone. Therefore we must be saved by love. Stuart leaned forward slightly in the chair. I have enemies, you know. Father Tim didn't say it, but he did know, of course. As you're aware, ours is the poorest of the southeastern dioceses. So far, the idea of a cathedral has been largely dismissed as flamboyant, self-seeking, a display of spiritual pride, a flagrant waste of money which could be used for higher purposes. And that's just for openers, I'm sure. The diocese exists in a culture in which a cathedral smacks of European decadence, though the Baptists down the road just built a church to seat 2,000, and nothing was thought of it, nothing at all. Where will the cathedral be built? Asked Father Tim, looking on the bright side. Stuart rose from the chair, grinning, and buttoned his jacket. Come, I'll show you on our way to lunch. This is a cow pasture, Stuart. He knew for a fact that he'd just stepped in something. Ah, Timothy, open your eyes. A cow pasture, yes, but one that slopes down to a magnificent view of the city. Look where we're standing, for heaven's sake. It's a habitation for angels. The wind swept words from their mouths. Their coats billowed and flapped like sails. Transept! Yelled Stuart, pointing toward the brow of the hill. Cruciform! He shouted, waving with outstretched arms. Though it was nearly impossible to distinguish what Stuart was saying, his bishop's countenance spoke volumes. He was as radiant as the youth Father Tim remembered all those years ago in seminary. They hurried back to the car, swept along by the chill wind at their backs. So here are the particulars, said Stuart, forgetting to put the key in the ignition. We'll build our cathedral of logs.
Logs?
Yes, honest materials, straight from our own highland forests, with scissor trusses of southern yellow pine, a roof of hand-split shakes, oak pews constructed by local artisans, I can't tell you how this excites me, Timothy. Plus, his bishop had a positive gleam in his eye. Plus, such materials are exceedingly cost-wise.
Aha.
We think we can do it for 6 million, said Stuart. A pittance, all things considered. At last we'll have what we've needed for so many years, a common meeting place for our scattered diocese, a center of learning, and one day, I trust, a great choir school. The bishop started the car, and they rolled slowly down the hill along the tree-lined street. "Pray for me in this," he said quietly. "I've been praying for you more than 40 years, my friend. Don't stop now. You know, of course, that you are faithfully in my prayers, and ever will be."
"Yes," said Father Tim, "and I'm grateful.
But I've talked too much about my own interests. Forgive me, Timothy. Tell me what brought you today. What's on your heart?" The discussion of a great cathedral was a tough act to follow, but there was hardly a beat between the question and his answer. "The mission field." Stuart winced visibly. "You're not keeping busy enough. Retirement generally gives too much time to think."
"Don't talk down to me, Stuart."
He hadn't treated Stuart's dream lightly, and he didn't take kindly to having his own casually dismissed. "You're right, of course. This is important to me and to Cynthia. Besides, the commission is to go and tell, not sit home and fossilize."
"I reacted that way because you're diabetic. You don't need to be stumbling around in some bleak outpost with no medical assistance."
"I take 2 insulin shots a day, monitor my sugar closely, eat at regular intervals, exercise 2 times a week. It's no big deal. Actually, my doctor would forbid a bleak outpost. We won't go far from home."
"Any idea where?"
"Somewhere in Appalachia," he said. "It's where the Dooley Barlows and Lace Harpers come from."
"Who is Lace Harper?"
"An exceptional young woman who's the adopted daughter of my doctor and his wife, off to her first year of college this fall. It wasn't long ago that she was living in the dirt under her house."
"Whatever for?"
"To escape a drunken father who beat her senseless."
"Dear Lord."
"Until the Harpers took her in, she was almost completely self-educated, thanks to the county bookmobile. Now she's one of the brightest stars her private school has ever seen." "We're exceedingly fond of Lace. We cherish the notion that someday she and Dooley might... well, you understand."
"I see. And your boy Dooley? He's doing well, isn't he?"
"A freshman at the University of Georgia, where he'll study veterinary medicine. If you recall, Dooley's the son of an abusive father he scarcely knew, and of a formerly alcoholic mother who gave her children away. Pauline has since come to know Christ and has married a believer. The transformation is wondrous. All this is to say, I've seen what a difference it can make for kids like Dooley and Lace to be given a break, to be loved. In truth, it makes all the difference." Stuart braked, waiting to turn left, and looked at his old friend. "An English missionary said, 'Some want to live within the sound of church and chapel bell. I want to run a rescue shop within a yard of hell.' You have my blessing." Of all his clergy, Timothy Cavanaugh had been the one he could depend on completely, the one whose theology never wavered and whose friendship genuinely counted. "I'll need your help, Stuart, your input about the ministries we should consider." The bishop wheeled into the restaurant parking lot and switched off the ignition. He looked at Father Tim and nodded his assent. "You'll have that, too," he promised. Chapter 2 Mixed Blessings
Lady Spring's Coy Flirtation Fails to Amuse by Hesse Mayhew. For 3 days in mid-February, Lady Spring cajoled our wintry spirits with zephyrs so balmy that we found ourselves utterly deceived. How quickly we forget, year to year, the heart-wrenching extent to which this frivolous and unrepentant lady betrays us. Our power lines felled by ice storms in March. Our rooftops laden with snow in April. Our lilacs lashed by bitter winds on May Day. One shudders to think what June may bring, the dear June that once gave us roses and clematis. While on the southerly slopes of the mountain the japonica has long since shed its crimson petals, we, hapless stepchildren that we are, must find delight, however piteous, in adorning our homes with sprigs of withered berries. However much the heart may yearn toward Lady Spring's vernal passage, hearken, I implore you, to the one bit of counsel that, come what may in this earthly life, will never ever betray you. Do not plant until May 15th. Hesse Mayhew's Annual Spring Angst. He sighed and dropped the newspaper to the floor. Once he'd clipped along through the Mitford Mews in 20-30 minutes max. Looking at his watch, he was dismayed to learn he'd just spent an hour and a half with the darn thing, as absorbed as if it were the Chicago Tribune. He'd even studied the classifieds, something seldom done in this life, and found his interest sincerely piqued by a walnut chest of drawers listed at a yard sale in Wesley. Retirement. That was the culprit. He snatched the latest Anglican Digest from the table by his chair and went at it, head down. "Mail call!" crowed his wife, never happier than when the mail had been chunked through the slot in the front door. And who wouldn't be ecstatic, he wondered. Scarcely a day passed that her devoted readers didn't express their admiration of her talent, beauty, wit, intelligence, and general benefit to mankind. She sat beside him on the study sofa and busied herself with sorting. Fan letter, fan letter, fan letter. Bill, bill, bill. Fan letter, junk mail, bill. She was, he noticed, piling the bills in his lap, not hers. Junk mail, fan letter, bill. Doo-wop, doo-wop, he said. She stopped sorting and tore open an envelope. Oh, lovely. It's not a fan letter. It's from Marion. Marion was their good and faithful friend from their interim on Whitecap Island. He always relished Marion's long, newsy letters. "Oh, my!" she burst into laughter. "What?" he said. "Ella Bridgewater's bird, Louise. Remember the canary that serenaded you? Well, it's not Louise at all. It's Louis. Marion has no earthly idea how Ella discovered this surprising fact, but it's the talk of St. John's." "Aha. Marion's going online, for Pete's sake, and wants our email address." "That will be the day." "And she and Sam send their love." "That's all? Louise is Louis, and they send their love?" "That's all, dearest. It's just a little note." "Oh," he said, disappointed. His wife moved quickly to other matters, using her letter opener to slice the flap of a white envelope. "My goodness," she murmured, reading. "Well, then..." She appeared briefly saddened, then looked at him and smiled. "What is it?" "I've been asked to tour the country with 4 other children's book authors and illustrators." "Tour the country?" The thought chilled his blood. He remembered her trip to Lansing several years ago to read at a school. She had arrived home very late, just as he was calling the police to begin a statewide search. with a program called READ, she said, glancing again at the letter. An acronym for Readers Earn Authors Day. Let's see. What a grand idea. Schools compete to read so many books, and those who reach or exceed the mark are eligible for a visit by Davant Medal authors. It all raises money for local literacy programs. And look, the other authors are my favorites. Her bright countenance frightened him. But of course I can't go, she said. And why not? Because it's the 1st of August, and we'll be in Tennessee. Right. He was flooded with relief. Of course. They were going to Tennessee in less than 2 months to join forces with Our Own Backyard, the mission project they'd long prayed might present itself. Dooley would finish his freshman year at college, spend a few days with them in Mitford, and head to Meadowgate for the summer to assist Hal Owen in his veterinary practice. Then Father Tim and Cynthia would tool across the state line to their year-long ministry in the newly formed OOB. The concept for this project, which was warmly endorsed by Stuart Cullen, had been developed by Father Rowland, whose research had uncovered dumbfounding truths about the extent of poverty and deprivation in an area around Jessup, Tennessee. There they would find alcohol and drug abuse, violence, severe medical and dental problems, families without transportation, unpaved roads, a high rate of school dropouts. Bottom line, an area not unlike Mitford's Creek community, before it had become a shopping center. Theirs would be a simple ministry, and as far as he was concerned, that was among its attractions. Along with Father Rowland and a zealous young Kentucky priest and his wife, they would live in the remote community much like other mountain families, except that each afternoon they would open the doors of their homes to whatever young people might come. There would be art classes and singing, Bible stories and books, food and games, a safe place, a good place. And on Sunday, he and the other two priests would celebrate and preach in the several widely scattered mission churches formed in the last century by ardent Anglican bishops. The move itself would be the soul of simplicity. They would load the Mustang with kitchen gadgetry, a bolt of mosquito netting, 5 suitcases, 4 pillows, and a heap of blankets. They would ship 36 pounds of art supplies and 200 books by truck. On arrival, they would set up housekeeping in a sparsely furnished metal building with a cement floor. His wife had paled when told about the metal building, and had nearly reneged on the whole deal when the subject of cement floors arose. But, she had said, it's not about cement floors. He patted her hand that held the letter. I'm sorry, he wanted to say, but didn't. And he really was sorry, for he liked nothing more than to see his wife able to give something back in her own way, in a way not connected to being a priest's wife. He looked into her earnest face and was shamed by his feelings. He was unutterably selfish. Deep down inside, he knew it. And no, he could never confess it to her, not in 1,000 years. At Mitford Blossoms, he asked Jenna Ivy for 12 roses, long-stemmed, without wires, fern, or gypsophila, please, in a box lined with green paper and tied with a pink satin ribbon. "Oh, I remember how she likes her roses," Jenna looked him in the eye, smiling. "And it's been ages since you've done this." He blushed. He was still smarting from the dark recognition that he desperately feared being separated from his wife. It had made him feel suddenly weak and frail, like a child. All those years alone, a bachelor who seldom yearned for the hearthstone of a wife's love—
And now he was a man beset with a dreadful mixture of anxiety and humiliation over the depth of his attachment. "Make that," the words lodged in his throat. "Make that 24". Jenna blinked, unbelieving. She had never known but one other man in Mitford to buy 24 roses at a whack, and that was Andrew Gregory, the mayor. Every time he and his Italian wife had an anniversary, Mr. Gregory hot-footed it to Mitford Blossoms and laid out cash money, no matter what the going rate. "Why, Father, Cynthia will think... she'll think you've gone round the bend." He forced a grin. "And she would be right," he said. "Tim?" It was John Brewster, director of the Children's Hospital in Wesley. "Yes, John, how are you, good fellow?" "Couldn't be better. I have some great news." "I'm eternally interested in great news." "We've finally got the funds to hire someone, strong, savvy, good at encouraging our donors, the kind of person who can really make a difference around here." "Terrific. This has been a long time coming." "A long time coming, and I'm asking you to consider the position." There was a brief silence. "We can talk about the particulars later. You're the absolutely perfect person for the job, Tim. Heaven sent, if you ask me. I hope you'll say yes." "Ah." He was oddly shaken. Yes, it was something he would like doing, and would, in fact, be pretty good at doing, but... "It's too late," he told the director. "I've recently made a commitment. Cynthia and I will be going up to Tennessee to work with the children's program. We'll come back to Mitford most weekends, but..." "I hate to hear this." He thought John sounded as if he might burst into tears. "I'm terribly disappointed. Everyone agreed that I should call you at once. Is there any chance the other thing could fall through, not work out?" "I don't think so. I'm sorry, too. I would have liked..." John sighed. "Well, then, we've got to dig deeper over here and reset our thinking. Ah, well, then, darn." He thought the director seemed fairly stricken. "It's not the end of the world," he wanted to say. "It's gracious of you to ask, John. I'm flattered, really." And he was. He felt a spring in his step as he went down the hall to Cynthia's studio and sat on her small love seat and told her what they'd just turned down. She came and sat in his lap and kissed the top of his head and hugged him wordlessly. "Dear Stuart, I've just recalled that Mahatma Gandhi said, 'First they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win.'" In his brotherhood, Timothy.
"Father!"
Helene Pringle dashed across the driveway and into the yard of the yellow house. He observed with some fondness that she bobbed when she dashed, rather like a small hare across an open field. She clutched a parcel in her hands, which she transferred to his.
"Bread!" she exclaimed, huffing a bit. "Just baked. I hope you and Cynthia will enjoy it."
"Thank you, Helene." The seductive warmth of the loaf seeped through the brown bag. "I just might eat the whole thing standing right here." His neighbor laughed with childlike merriment. What a transformation had occurred in this small, once faint-hearted Frenchwoman who had moved next door from Boston 2 or 3 years ago. He hardly ever thought of it now, but they'd gotten off to an exceedingly rough start. Helene had not only stolen a valuable bronze off his mantle, she'd sued him for big bucks, and all the while living in and renting his house. Thank heaven he'd dropped his charges, she'd withdrawn the lawsuit, and he and Cynthia now had the finest neighbor on God's green earth. In truth, Helene Pringle had grown in grace
and stretched her wings considerably. "Warming up," he said of the weather, and was glad to hear such words from his mouth. "Oui, j'adore le printemps." "Oh, excuse me, Father, I always speak French when I'm excited."
"I saw Françoise yesterday. She looks strong and happy." Hélène had managed to bring her mother from Boston and install her at Hope House, where, though plagued by several complications of heart disease, she was flourishing.
"Mother loves your visits, Father. Thank you for all you and Cynthia do for us. One day, I promise, I shall repay you in some important way. Absolument."
"Don't even think it. Merely observing your happiness here gives us a double portion."
"3 new students, Father. That's 15 now, and I think I mustn't accept more. I never thought I'd be able to say such a thing."
Hélène consulted her watch.
"Ça, par exemple, it's nearly time for Sophie Hawthorne's 11 o'clock."
Hélène's piano teaching had introduced a pleasing new dimension to Mitford. He felt personally proud of her success, though he'd had nothing at all to do with it.
"Please help yourself to your roses when they bloom, Father. I must tell you I'm grateful to live in the home of a gardener. Well, à bientôt."
"Au revoir, Hélène. Oh, and merci." He estimated that his French vocabulary now included a whopping 10 or 12 words. She gave a fluttering wave, then darted across the driveway and over the lawn of the rectory and up the steps. He smiled, precisely like a hare. As he walked into the hall from the front door, he observed his wife standing by the living-room window.
"I saw you talking with Hélène. I thought she might eat you with a spoon on the very spot where you stood."
"Spying on me," he said.
"It's true, darling, but only while washing a smudge off the window pane. I think she's mad for you, but in an altogether decent way, of course."
He judged Cynthia's eyes to be precisely the color of chicory blossoms, soon to appear in the fields around Mitford. He set the bread in a chair and bounded to her and took her in his arms. "Why would you be jealous of me, for goodness sake?" He was laughing as he said it, but he really wanted to know, needed to know. He suddenly craved to hear her say something that would knock his socks off. She was good at that.
"But I'm not jealous of you at all."
"You're not?"
"Of course not. Hélène is a lovely woman who's scarcely ever known a decent man until she met her neighbor, which is exactly the way I felt when I started popping through the hedge."
Ah, popping through the hedge. That had been the modus operandi of their courtship. He felt positively nostalgic just hearing her mention the hedge.
"Besides, Timothy, I know you'll love me till death do us part, and then forever."
She put her arms around his neck, and he kissed her tenderly, inhaling her warm scent. But since she'd brought it up, he would have liked her to be jealous, if only a little. He broke the news as they sat at the kitchen table.
"Not again," wailed Puny. "You just went off a little bit ago. I can't even think about you going off again."
"Just for a year," he said, feeling like a traitor.
"Yes, sir, Reverend. Seems like we ain't hardly got settled down from the last time you went off," said Harley.
Harley Welsh was his friend, his handyman, his brother in the Lord, his neighbor who lived in Hélène Pringle's basement.
"We're going to work with children who've been terribly hurt by their circumstances," Cynthia explained. "It's a wonderful program that will help families find healing."
"But you got children right here," said Puny, struggling to understand. "I mean, they're not really hurt or anything, even if I did spank Sassy something awful for playing with matches."
Puny's red-haired twins, Sissy and Sassy, had been part of the Cavanaugh household since birth.
Now they usually came home each day to the Yellow House from Mitford School's second grade. Father Tim glanced at Cynthia, who was clearly sobered by the gloomy response to their news. Didn't they have a perfect right to do whatever they pleased? Didn't they deserve the freedom to pursue God's plan for their lives? And here were two lower lips positively hanging to the floor. Harley shook his head and sighed. "Now listen," Father Tim said in his pulpit voice. Aha! That was the ticket. That got their attention. From now on, it would be tell, don't ask. "We're going to Tennessee, but we can't do it without you. No, indeed, we'd be in a pickle. In truth, if the Lord hadn't provided the two of you to care for things around here, I doubt if we'd be able to answer this call. Harley, you're to keep the 2 yards mowed, pruned up, and fertilized. Puny, you're to do the outstanding job you did while we were in Whitecap. We'll come home on frequent weekends as hungry as bears, so load up the refrigerator and don't spare the tomato aspic. Harley."
"Yes, sir."
Harley had snapped too. "Be sure and take Dooley's grandpa his liver mush, as Dooley will be at Meadowgate with the Owens this summer. Further, I'd like you to go out to the farm now.